Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
With In and Out of This World, Material and Extraterrestrial Bodies in the Nation of Islam, Stephen Finley examines the religious practices and discourses that have shaped the Nation of Islam in America, drawing on the speeches and writing of figures such as Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Warth Deen Muhammad, and Louis Farrakhan. Finley shows that the Nation of Islam and its leaders use multiple religious symbols, rituals, and mythologies meant to recast the meaning of the cosmos and create new transcendent and immanent black bodies whose meaning cannot be reduced to products of racism. Whether examining how the myth of Yaqub helped Elijah Muhammad explain the violence directed at black bodies, how Malcolm X made black bodies in the Nation of Islam publicly visible, or the ways Farrakhan's discourses on his experiences with the Mother Wheel UFO organized his interpretation of black bodies, Finley demonstrates that the Nation of Islam intended to retrieve, reclaim, and reform black bodies in a context of anti-black violence. In our conversation, we discuss the theoretical framework of in or out of place, the body as both social and symbolic, the Nation of Islam mythological and cosmological narratives, Elijah Muhammad's theological vision for African Americans, Malcolm X's focus on civil and human rights movements, Warth Deen Muhammad's notion of race, the identity of Bilalians, Louis Farrakhan's mystical extraterrestrial experiences, and women's embodiment in the Nation of Islam. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Now, here's my conversation with Stephen Finley about In and Out of This World, Material and Extraterrestrial Bodies in the Nation of Islam, published with Duke University Press in 2022.
Welcome, Stephen. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you doing?
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this conversation, and yeah. I'm doing pretty well.
Great. Yeah, I'm excited too, because this really is a wonderful book, In and Out of This World, Material and Extraterrestrial Bodies in the Nation of Islam. I think a lot of people will be excited to hear this conversation, and a lot of people will be excited to get their hands on this book. So I hope they will soon. We always start our New Books interviews a little bit with about our authors, though. So if you could you share with us a little bit about your background, training, perhaps moments or mentors that were influential for you in terms of what brought you to the study of religion and the particular subjects you're interested in?
Sure, I appreciate that. I grew up in Southern California, in Santa Ana, California, which is just south of Los Angeles. And I've always been interested in religion. I moved in the mid-90s to Virginia, and I did my first graduate degree there at Virginia Union University, which was actually in the School of Theology. And so I always knew that the study of religion was something that I wanted to do. I think it was at that point where I decided I really wanted to be a professor, and that was in the mid-90s, mid to late 1990s. I applied to Rice University in 2002, and I was accepted there. And my statement, you know, you have to write a personal statement, as you know, for these applications, engaged African-American, Muslim, and Hebrew movements. And so I've always been interested in these particular African-American religious currents, whereas the field of the study of African-American religion is largely dominated by Christian studies and Black church studies. And so I was really happy to end up at Rice University, where I could study with really great scholars related to this project, including David Cook, whose work you probably know in Islamic studies. And my dissertation, which was on the Nation of Islam, was formative for this project, and the late Lawrence Mamiya, whose work you may also know, was on my committee. And so I've always been interested in trends outside of churches in African American religion, especially those that are esoteric and mystical. And so this project came together in a way that captured all of my interests at the time. And as I reworked the project over time, I tried to incorporate some of those emphases on the esoteric and UFOs and those kind of things that interest me so much these days.
Yeah, that stuff is it's unique, and there's not a lot of people that are working on it, especially within the Nation of Islam. So it's great to kind of get that perspective from your book. Can you talk a little bit about how the project kind of started to emerge for you and come together, especially around one of the things I think that the book does really well is kind of makes this a very interesting theoretical kind of intervention around kind of the idea of embodiment and the kind of racial logics that go along with that. Can you talk a little bit about how this started to form for you? It sounds like some of this work was done for your dissertation, but it's been kind of, you know, cooking for a long time, it seems. So how did it come together?
Well, I appreciate that acknowledgement first. I was interested in an approach to the Nation of Islam that would be unique or largely unique among scholarship on the Nation of Islam. That is to say, a lot of the projects are descriptive, and those are important projects. But I wanted to go a step further than some of the projects I have in mind, many of them, and talk not just about what the Nation of Islam was doing, but also what it means, why they were doing it. And like you said, the racial logics and religious behind a lot of the Nation of Islam's practices and discourses. And so it came together in that way, trying to make sense of the nation from a religious studies perspective, that is, with theory and method in mind. And so I'm sure as you read the book, you can see that that's part of what you're signaling in your question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so one of the kind of theoretical threads throughout the book is this this use of this idea of Black bodies and then Black bodies that are in place and out of place. And yes. I've already recommended and sent the I'm glad the intro is online. I've already sent it to someone to recommend it to them. But can you explain kind of this theoretical framework that you use for the book?
Sure. So again, my point here is to try to give some coherence to what the Nation of Islam is doing and why, over against these prevailing narratives about the Nation of Islam, almost all of which are false. Almost nothing that you read or your audience will read on the internet and in more popular venues are accurate with respect to the Nation of Islam. They really get reduced to a couple pejorative tropes. And they're far more complicated than that. And so with Black bodies in and out of place, this theoretical framework that I use to help make sense of the Nation of Islam, I was trying to make sense of how the Nation of Islam in various moments in their life, how they gave new meaning to Black embodiment, whose primary meaning has been attached to Blackness by way of slavery and lynching and Jim Crow and philosophies of Black inferiority and so forth. And so one of the things that Black Bodies In and Out of Place helps us to see is the enormous complexity and the ways that cosmologies, social systems, and bodies are intertwined. That's really important. I mean, that's really what I was trying to get at. How is Black embodies, and indeed, how are all bodies connected to social systems, their meaning connected to social systems, which themselves are connected to cosmologies and ways of understanding the world. And so I wanted to see the Nation of Islam in that larger, complicated context in order to make more sense and to give shed more light on why they were doing the things they were doing with the rituals, including, you know, how they dressed, the food they ate, and so on.
Now, some listeners might not be totally familiar with the Nation of Islam. Do you think you could just give us some key things we need to know about the Nation of Islam as a kind of tradition to get into your project? What are kind of the key features you think people need to know about?
Sure. I'm talking about the Nation of Islam in particular, as we understand it through Minister Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam. Of course, there are lots of Nation of Islams. There always have been. When Elijah Muhammad, the early prophet, died in 1975, there were probably at least a dozen splinter groups that emerged that all claimed the legitimate and rightful heirs to his teachings. And I'm looking at the Nation of Islam. I'm starting and taking a sort of a retrospective view. I'm looking at the Nation of Islam from Louis Farrakhan and before that, and tying him to that lineage because he does. I mean, there are some important things that he says and does that for him makes his Nation of Islam the legitimate Nation of Islam. But even to this day, there are rival groups in the Nation of Islam, a few of which actually started before the death of Elijah Muhammad in 1975. But the group traces its lineage back to Detroit in 1930. Incidentally, and very symbolically, of course, they claimed July 4th, 1930, as the day that they were founded there in Paradise Valley in Detroit. And so that's the Nation of Islam that interests me. But I did want to make the point for listeners that there are lots of other groups that are called the Nation of Islam, each of which claims to be the legitimate heir to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, that they all claim came from the founder, Master Farag Muhammad, who was initially understood as God for the movement.
And you talk about some of these kind of origins in the beginning of the book, where you focus on Elijah Muhammad. And, one of the things that I think is very helpful about your book is you kind of lay out these, what we might think of as kind of a theological vision for each Yes. of these figures, and even a cosmological vision. So can you tell us a little bit about who Elijah Muhammad was and what his theological vision was for African Americans in the kind of mid 20th century?
Sure. That's actually kind of a complicated question. Elijah Muhammad was born right around 1897 in October, I think October 7th. And he was born at a time in Georgia, in Cordele, Georgia, when African-Americans were being lynched all around him. In fact, one of the traumatic events of his life, I think he might have been 10, 11, somewhere in there, was when his friend Howard was lynched. And this kind of violence, this kind of white racial terror and violence that was directed at specifically at Black bodies was really formative for him. And of course, his background, as many African Americans in the South, was a Christian one, and that's really important in terms of how he started thinking about the world and trying to make sense of it. And lynchings became really really important to him. I mean, one of the traumatic events, of course, was when an African American male, because most of them the lynchings were men, was lynched in his hometown. And the white people who lynched this person put the body in the center of the Black community as a sign to Black people that this is what happens when they step out of place, when they are perceived not to be in their cosmologically designated position of inferiority in this world, a sort of cosmology, white cosmology, that had white people at the center as a given. Like this wasn't a chance. This is the way of the universe, that white people were centered and were always to be in charge. And he grew up at a time, you know, at the turn of the century, when in Georgia, there was probably the largest number of lynchings than in any other place in any other time. Literally dozens of lynchings, more than 100 lynchings at the turn of the century. And so Elijah Muhammad was really trying to make sense of his reality and the sense of the vulnerability of Black people. And one of the questions he asked himself is, you know, where are all the men? Black people are getting lynched, and Black adults, in particular Black men, can't do anything about it. What's that about, that sense of vulnerability and terror, that in the sense that Black bodies were expendable, that they could be slaughtered and burned, and disarticulated and mutilated at any time? And I want your audience to try to feel their way into that, to try to get a sense for what that must have been like to live in a Black community where Elijah Muhammad perceived Black people were basically powerless to do anything within this particular social system, which would punish them for doing anything, standing up for themselves, speaking out on behalf of Black people, sometimes to the point of death. And so that's really important to note as a sort of beginnings of Elijah Muhammad thinking about what it means to be Black. What does Blackness mean in this world where Black bodies are vulnerable and are subject to gratuitous violence in which the system offers no relief? And so that's really where I want to start. And often when I do presentations on the Nation of Islam, I start by showing pictures of lynchings in front of well-dressed white crowds who would bring their children, who would snap pictures in front of mangled and burning bodies, children and people who were smiling. These were momentous occasions for these white people. But for Black people, they were terrifying, right? Imagine living in a horror film and not seeing any way out of this violence. And I really want people to get that, because that's where Elijah Muhammad starts. That was the way he understood and experienced the world. A world in which Black people were even seen in zoos, like Otabenga, who was an African, I believe, from the what they used to call the Pygmies, who was in, I think it was the Bronx Zoo, where Black people were even kept in cages. And this was following slavery. So it wasn't just the lynchings, but there's this long history of white racial terror that subjects Black bodies, Black embodiment to the whims of whiteness, both those who are in official positions and those who are not, that they were always subject. And so, again, I want folks to get their minds around that. How might they think about the world? And then think about the narrative that you pointed to that shows up that I try to lay out in the first chapter. Sort of reworking, trying to think about the world in a way that makes sense of all of this.
Yeah, and you show how Elijah Muhammad kind of utilizes or deploys kind of key mythological, cosmological understandings to reflect on his position within this kind of lived experience. Can you lay out what are these kind of these mythological narratives? You specifically talk about the myth of Yaqub. Yes. And how does this help Muhammad kind of understand the role of the Black body in American society?
The myth of Yaqub, which is not my term, it's a term, of course, that I inherited from scholarship, but also from the Nation of Islam. Of course, they don't call it a myth. I'm calling it a myth because I want to understand it as highly symbolic, as almost theodician, not even almost. It's theodician in the sense that it tries to make sense of Black suffering in a world where, again, Black people die almost for nothing, just for being perceived as being out of place physically or socially or symbolically. And Elijah Muhammad then claims to learn the secret knowledge about the true nature of the universe, the true nature of the origins of the world and the planets and of the races from Master Farad Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam, whose origins are also shrouded in mystery. And so it's a really complicated narrative or mythology about all sorts of things that initially one would have had to have been a part of the Nation of Islam to hear. This was secret knowledge. It was imparted from master to teacher. It was given to those who were in relationship to the teachers in the Nation of Islam about the true nature of the universe. And so it starts with the very origins of the planets. And the universe. And it goes all the way through. I divide it into five parts. If you ask me about what what those five parts are off the top of my head, I'm not sure I'll be able to do it. But it ends, of course, with the world being remade at the coming of this mother plane, this vehicle of destruction and regeneration that Elijah Muhammad said he learned from Master Farad Muhammad, that was built by Japanese scientists on the Japanese islands in 1929. And of course, Japanese were also understood as Black. And so this mythology, this cosmology really understands the world very, very differently. When I say Blackness, I'm really talking about Blackness as what I call this surplus category. Blackness refers to Black, brown, red, and yellow people, to use the nomenclature of the Nation of Islam, but it also refers to Black people on other planets, such as Mars and Venus. And all of this appears in the Nation of Islam's narrative as a means of giving Black bodies a sense of transcendence. This is what I argue. All of these narratives about Black life, the true meaning of it being secretive and being lodged in the symbols of Freemasonry, Black life on other planets where Black people live to be 1,200 years old, 9 feet tall, and so on. And Blackness as this expansive category of humanity that can't be captured and reduced to the white racial terror and the logics and white racial logics are significant given where I started, Elijah Muhammad's background, to give the Nation of Islam a new sense of being, a new sense of who they are, and a new sense of pride and authority to engage a world that treated Black people like they were not human, like they were, again, just expendable bodies, right? Pure eminence. And so the Nation of Islam, through this narrative, understood Blackness then as transcendent, not simply just immanent. Blackness and the meaning of Blackness was connected to other planets, to this UFO that they call the mother wheel or the mother plane. And again, as such, can't be reduced then to the meaning of Blackness that might be attached because of slavery or narratives of Black inferiority or lynchings. And this is what I was trying to point out by laying out that narrative, which actually was quite challenging, because there is no one version of the narrative of Yaqub. It's in bits and pieces in dozens and dozens of speeches and sermons and writings. And so it really takes a lot and a lot of attention and time to read through all of this and to try to put it together and to render it one coherent story and organize it in a way, like I said, I organize it into five parts that allows readers to make sense of it.
Yeah, and so part of what you do with this theoretical frame we were talking about earlier, around in place and out of place, the other kind of component here is that each of the figures that you look at as kind of representative also are focused variously upon kind of the social role of Blackness versus symbolic role of Blackness. And for Elijah Muhammad, it seems that he's interested in this kind of more symbolic understanding that he constructs through specific ritualized and then these Correct. Mythologized differences that you kind of lay out here. Can you just tell us, you know, how did the social part, how did he kind of articulate the construction of an ideal Black body through the kind of social aspect of being a member of the Nation of Islam, for example?
Well, let me go back first to answer your question and say that I don't understand Black bodies in and out of place as a binary. I understand it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And of course, it's whether a Black body is in place or out of place has everything to do with perception. And a perception, again, from the white racial logics that I'm trying to make apparent here. And of course, one can be perceived to be in place or out of place socially, or in place or out of place symbolically. And again, even that is connected to a particular social system. I'm talking primarily here of the United States, which again is connected to a certain cosmology of whiteness as central. Let's just say white supremacy. And so I want to make that clear. And having said that, Elijah Muhammad was much more interested in the symbolic aspects of this rethinking, remaking Black bodies. He was interested in making Black bodies beautiful culturally and religiously. And so this is why his focus was on these religious ideas and these religious practices. Of course, you're talking about and you're asking me about the social aspects. And by social aspects, when I say socially in place or out of place, I'm talking about the physical body. And so I don't want to make it seem like he didn't give that attention to. What I'm arguing in the book is that he privileged the symbolic. But of course, the social was really important too, when you're talking about the vitality the physical vitality of Black bodies whose lifespan and life expectancy was considerably lower than it is now, and considerably below the average lifespan. I mean, there were times when the average slave might have lived 20 years, 20, 25 years. And so this idea of helping to reform or remake Black bodies in a way that gave them physical vitality was also really important to Elijah Muhammad. And this is why we see in his work the attention to the diet, or how these bodies are adorned, the kinds of activities that they were allowed to participate in and not allowed to participate in. Early on, of course, they weren't able to participate in political processes like the civil rights movement, right? All of those were really important because you're talking about a religious leader who was preparing these bodies, these people, for something religious, right? And so he privileged the symbolic, but it doesn't mean that he ignored the physical body. In fact, he gave the physical body quite a bit of attention. But also, he wanted to control the activity of the physical bodies in service of the symbolic, which is to say, anything that would give bodies negative value, such as buffooning, or participating in certain social activities like entertainment, that he saw would take them away or change their meaning or not give them the religious meaning that he was seeking, he would restrict. It doesn't mean that members of the Nation of Islam didn't have freedom, that they didn't do what they wanted to do. In many cases, there's lots of evidence that said they did. But in terms of his logic, he was focused on the symbolic because he was preparing these people, these members, for the world to come, and not simply just for this world.
I mean, there's a lot more to cover, of course, that readers will have to pick up the book to explore. You move through the book through these kind of central figures, beginning with Elijah Muhammad. You move to Malcolm X, and part of what you do is you show both the kind of differences of Malcolm's approach and his prioritizing of the social over the symbolic.
Correct.
But you also, which I think is key, is you also kind of account for the kind of continuities that were the threads both, you know, during his time in the Nation and then after his, the split or his so-called break. Can you talk a little bit about where Malcolm fits into these kind of ideas about Blackness within kind of American society and then kind of how it's placed within relation, I guess, to Elijah Muhammad's vision?
I can do that. And one of the things I should point out in terms of the continuity, Elijah Muhammad, what I talk about for Elijah Muhammad is that there were these features that became important with respect to which bodies were seen as more significant than others. And I call that Elijah Muhammad's ideal embodied economy. And these are features such as complexion, gender, intelligence, all sorts of things that I want to show have their place and play out throughout the life of all these iterations of the Nation of Islam, even though these people I'm talking about don't always agree with one another. And that's something else that I'm pushing in this book, is that they critiqued one another. And that's what you're pointing out when you're saying that I argue that Malcolm privileged the social over the symbolic, and you're exactly right. Part of what I wanted to show is that for Malcolm X, Black bodies have their greatest importance and meaning when they're actually physically active in taking a hold of the world that oppresses them and trying to change that world, which means participating in political processes, engaging systems of white supremacy that marginalize Black people, that limit who and what they can be, and doing something about that. Whereas Malcolm understood Elijah Muhammad as limiting that, because Elijah Muhammad, again, and I want to emphasize this, was first and foremost a religious leader. And it doesn't mean that Malcolm X wasn't. He was indeed. But he thought that the Nation of Islam could have been the greatest force the world has ever seen in the civil rights movement. And he longed to see Black people stand up and the Nation of Islam participate in that movement, which they were restricted from, in which they were restricted from participating. And so what we see in Malcolm X, I argue, is the privileging of the social over the symbolic. And that's what you're getting at in that chapter 3 on Malcolm X. And I argue that is an implied critique of Elijah Muhammad.
Focus also on Warith Deen Muhammad and his role and leadership in the Nation of Islam and kind of its emergence out of this kind of post-Nation of Islam period. He might be the least familiar of the figures you focus on to listeners, though. So do you think you could start just telling us a little bit about who W.D. Muhammad was, what happened under his leadership?
Yes, Wallace was initially his name, was the seventh son, the seventh child of Elijah Muhammad. And Wallace had a really contentious relationship with the Nation of Islam. His father, of course, was Elijah Muhammad. And Wallace grew to be suspicious of the teachings of the Nation of Islam. He left the Nation of Islam on a few occasions, but according to him and the scholarly record, returned often because he felt threatened, physically threatened, when he left the Nation of Islam. When Elijah Muhammad died in 1975, he assumed leadership of the Nation of Islam, but he was much more interested in the nation embracing a more universal, at least in his eyes, version or Sunni version of Islam. And so in 1975, of course, he maneuvered to take over the Nation of Islam and to be its leader, even though one could argue that there were signals that the leader should have been Minister Louis Farrakhan. And so that that whole thing is really complicated. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. But I also talk about how, in many ways, Warith, as he came to be known, it is in his embrace of Sunni Islam, utilized the teachings of his father to frame himself as, including some of these esoteric ideas that come from Black folklore, like being the seventh born son, to frame himself as the rightful leader of the Nation of Islam. And so immediately after he takes over the Nation of Islam, he started moving the group toward a more universal practice of Islam. And at the same time, I argue race continued to be very important to him. Warith Deen Muhammad recognized that white supremacy had done something to devalue the body for Black people. And he wanted to ennoble, and that's the word he used, and give culture to Black people, which he thought Islam could do, Islam broadly understood. And so I try to make some sense of that, to connect him to the Nation of Islam, but also to be specific and give specific attention about where he was going and the logics behind his embrace of Islam more broadly, but also why he thought race and culture were really, really important to give attention to. So I argue, of course, that the symbolic was very important for him as well.
Yeah, and you do a really good job of kind of showing how these connections between the universality of Islam and the particular experiences of African Americans are mediated through his kind of teachings and perspectives. One of the kind of key shifts that he made in thinking about African American Muslims was the use of this term Bilalians.
Yes.
Can you tell us what he meant by this term, where it came from, and why it made sense for him to use this?
Sure, because on the one hand, I understand what Worthing was trying to do with this notion of African Americans as Bilalians. On another hand, it was enormously problematic. And so one of the things I try to do in the book is show how the Nation of Islam in all these iterations give attention to these transcendental symbols, Black life on other planets, Bilal, UFOs, and so on, to give new meaning to Blackness, a new meaning to Black embodiment. And Bilal was a slave who was really important for Waruthi Muhammad because he was Black and because he was a slave. And so because he played a prominent role as a prayer caller in his relationship with the Prophet Muhammad, Waruthi Muhammad seized upon that and his prominent role in Islam to suggest that this would be an appropriate symbol for a new meaning of Black embodiment for African Americans. And so on the one hand, I totally get the logics, right? This need to do something different that gave Black people a new reference that was different from the story of Yaqub, which he would have rejected, but at the same time, which had the power to ennoble Black bodies. And so he took Bilal and made Bilal transcendental, such that Bilal became the symbol of the greatness of Black people within an Islamic context, which was also the problem, right? This imposition of this Islamic identity upon all Black people, in particular African Americans. And so he came to refer to African Americans as Bilalian, which again is a form of violence on the one hand, because what gives him the right to claim this identity for all Black people and say this is who Black people are. On the other hand, it's totally understandable because he wanted to lift the meaning of Blackness, the meaning of Black bodies from this genealogy of suffering and violence, which was the reference prior to this.
And we talked about him a little bit, but the latter half of the book focuses on the leadership and role and religious thought of Louis Farrakhan, who a lot of people probably know as a controversial public
Sure.
figure. But that's maybe all they know about him. And you do a great job of kind of exploring his role as a kind of religious leader as well. So can you tell us a little bit about his vision for the nation once he took over? What are some of his key ideas or practices that kind of make him a central figure within this narrative?
I'm not sure that there's a more misunderstood religious figure in America than Louis Farrakhan. But Louis Farrakhan, it was around 1977 when Farrakhan decided that the teachings of Waruthi Muhammad had corrupted the teachings of his father, Elijah Muhammad. And around 1977, he told Brock Peters. Brock Peters was an actor. I can see his face in my mind right now, that he was going to reconstitute the nation, by which he meant going back to what he saw as the authentic and true teachings of Elijah Muhammad. And he did this in 1978, this reconstitution. Of course, he also felt like he was put out of the Nation of Islam and marginalized in Warithi Muhammad's Nation of Islam, which only lasted for, you know, maybe a few years. I think it was even 1978, Warithi Muhammad lectured to the American Academy of Religion, where he was actually, he still used the term Nation of Islam. But for the most part, the Nation of Islam, as we understood it up to this point, that is mid to late 1970s, no longer existed. And so this isn't a clear lineage. The Nation of Islam under Minister Louis Farrakhan is basically a new Nation of Islam. Now, he might not look at it that way. Members of the Nation of Islam might not see it that way. They would see that they're the heirs to the true teachings of the Nation of Islam, and they would see themselves as sort of an unbroken lineage. But Minister Farrakhan, around 1978, took a remnant of those who had been members of the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad and Warithi Muhammad, along with mostly new members, many of whom came from African-American churches, were new converts in Black communities, in prisons, and so on, to start a very new Nation of Islam. And that brings us pretty much where we are to this day. And Minister Louis Farrakhan has tried very, very diligently to be true to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, while at the same time embracing a much broader notion of Islam. And so for him, members of the Nation of Islam are Muslims in the broader and global sense. Yet there is a particularity to Black experience in America that only the Nation of Islam can speak to from Minister Farrakhan. And this is where we start getting some of the ideas about things like UFOs and returning to the importance of the story of Yaqub that are so prominent in the religion and thought of the Nation of Islam today. In fact, I argue that the most significant and important religious idea for the Nation of Islam and Minister Farrakhan is the idea of the UFO, or what they call the mother wheel or the mother plane. Now I have to say something very, very quickly. The mother wheel becomes important for Minister Farrakhan because he claims to have had a vision, literally an out-of-body experience, in the language of the Nation of Islam, in which he was taken into this mother wheel, this vehicle, in 1985, September 17, 1985, on a mountain in Mexico. Of course, listeners will have to read the book to get all of the complicated details. But the point I want to make here is, I want to understand this narrative of the mother wheel, in which he claims to have been taken into, and hearing the voice of Elijah Muhammad and experiencing the presence of Elijah Muhammad and Master Farrakhan Muhammad as an authorizing event that told him and the world that Minister Farrakhan and this Nation of Islam was the true Nation of Islam over against all the other claims of people who were in these other nations of Islam movements who claim legitimacy. And so it's really the central narrative that scholarship has largely missed precisely because they don't know what to do with it. And this is, of course, where theory and method in the study of religion, I argue, and theory in particular, is so important. Because for me, the story of Yaqub, this idea of a UFO, and all of this makes perfect sense, understood, first of all, over against a history of white racial terror. But secondly, in the immediate sense, in the 1970s, over against claims of others that their movement was the true movement that had the right to the lineage of the teachings of Elijah Muhammad.
It's really interesting, and some of the people that I know that were most excited about the book were people that are doing work on UFO religion and new religious movements. And so you're really making a contribution to lots of different areas, which is great. Congratulations for that.
Thank you. And if I might say,
yeah, please.
I appreciate that that insight and that acknowledgement. For the Nation of Islam, they've been talking about UFOs for a long time. But I want these narratives of the UFO in the Nation of Islam to be understood against the enormous interest in the last several years. The government disclosures of UFOs. Actually, last week, the Office of Defense National Intelligence released a new report on UFOs, some 500 cases that weren't reported when they released their unclassified report in, I think it was 2020, in June or July. And the enormous attention that NASA is now giving to UFOs, or the Galileo Project at Harvard, of which I'm also an affiliate researcher. And the Nation of Islam, they're going to argue that no one can understand this UFO phenomena without them, because this UFO actually says something specific about who they are and who Black people are. So they hold the key to all of this UFO craze. I shouldn't call it craze, but all of this UFO interest that you're mentioning among the UFO enthusiasts, among scholars and governmental groups and the military. And so they want to see themselves as central to this conversation, and that the world needs, including the government, needs to include them in this conversation, because they hold the key to what these UFOs really mean. Whereas the world, scientists, government, military, and otherwise, misrecognize what they're calling UFOs. They are really this mother wheel and these 1,500 baby wheels that are inside, or bombing planes, as Louis Farrakhan calls them, inside this mother wheel. So when people say they see UFOs, what they're really seeing are these baby wheels or baby planes. And so it really is, and again, I want listeners to get that. They want to reduce all of this enormous recent attention as significant, ultimately, for who Black people really are, and the importance of the Nation of Islam and Minister Farrakhan himself, who says that he's going to this mother plane, this mother wheel, after he ostensibly dies.
Yeah, it's super interesting, and you do a great job of kind of laying out both the kind of material social aspect of this, but then also the kind of cosmological and transcendent sure. perspective. So at the end of the book, you kind of try to take a bird's eye view of these various perspectives that are put forth, and how they kind of idealize or understand an ideal Black body. And you kind of take them to account in thinking about kind of communal difference within the African-American community, and how their vision of Blackness in some ways can perpetuate the kind of terrors of white supremacy, as you've been describing. So can you talk a little bit about kind of how differences such as class or gender or even religious differences might kind of discount Blackness in some particular ways for these figures?
I'll say this very quickly. One of the things I'm trying to do is to be, again, a really faithful interpreter of the Nation of Islam over against a lot of sound that I think misreads, misinterprets, misunderstands the Nation of Islam, while at the same time being a critical scholar of African-American religion, and in this case of the Nation of Islam. And one of the things that I was trying to point out is that there's this line of reasoning and logic within all of the cosmology of the Nation of Islam, that seeks to remake Black embodiment, that also marginalizes various embodiments within the Nation of Islam, that within the world and African-American community that don't line up to theirs. And so what I argue is there's sort of a hierarchy and a class discourse. And I don't mean that in the Marxist sense. Obviously, you know, I'm using Pierre Bourdieu to make sense of this, but that this embodiment in the Nation of Islam comes the closest to this ideal Black embodiment that we initially get from Elijah Muhammad. And that those bodies that don't line up to this, I argue, are marginal and marginalized within these narratives and discourses. And that's basically these other discourses about Blackness among African Americans. And that's basically what I'm trying to point out there.
Yeah. You also, I'm glad you added it at the end, a kind of small addendum about how, you know, we've been talking all about men, really, how the role of Black women play in the Nation of Islam. What are your thoughts on how your book and your approach might help us think about the role of women in the nation?
One of the things that I tried to do in the epilogue was give specific theoretical attention to the meaning of Black women's embodiment in the Nation of Islam. And of course, it's an interpretive but also critical perspective that I think is necessary to make sense of it. But I also wanted to signal that we need much more attention to women in the Nation of Islam and what they mean. And the critical part, of course, is I'm arguing that the ultimate meaning of Black women's embodiment can only be gleaned through Minister Farrakhan's body and this UFO or this mother wheel. But also to point out that the gap in scholarship on women in the Nation of Islam. And that's really what I was trying to do there, both to highlight women's agency in the Nation of Islam, but to point out how we have missed in much of that scholarship what they mean in the Nation of Islam.
The other thing that you do at the end, which is great, is you know, the project of the book really is largely historical, in the sense that it's kind of looking at these kind of key moments and these key figures. But you kind of circle back at the end to Farrakhan's perspective, basically today.
Yes.
And you focus on a kind of significant speech he did in 2020 on Savior's Day. And this speech was particularly important because it kind of makes some kind of synthesis of his role, his teachings, and kind of reflects a little on his legacy. And then you were lucky enough to even add some final words on things that were happening just a few months ago, which is amazing. So maybe you could just help us think about where does Farrakhan see the Nation of Islam and kind of understand the role of Blackness in our kind of present moment?
One of the things that I was trying to do at the end of the book is to allow Farrakhan to speak in his own words and in his own voice, again, over against the critical noise that has largely constructed Minister Farrakhan in their own ways. And to argue that he's misunderstood, that his intention is much more universal, with respect to how he sees the Nation of Islam, and to connect that with current trends in UFO studies among scientists and scholars of religion and others in the humanity, and to push for a new and more complicated look at Minister Farrakhan that brackets, to the extent possible, some of the misnomers and some of the more inflammatory ways that the public has come to understand Farrakhan. And this is why I say in that afterword that this the Farrakhan who appears in that particular part of the book and in that speech will be unrecognizable, will be illegible over against public pronouncements about Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. And I wanted to leave us with that and also criticize some of the scholarship and some of the pseudo scholarship on the Nation of Islam that has got us to that point. Because I think in many ways, these narratives have kept us from seeing the more complicated Nation of Islam and the depths of it that as a scholar, I want to make apparent. And that's how that last part for me functioned.
Well, Stephen, it's a great book, beautiful cover. I'm so glad it's out in the world. Congratulations. Before I let you go, listeners that are sticking with us this long certainly will want to know what you have kind of in the pipeline. What kind of things are you working on nowadays?
Well, I have two other books under contract. One is a book actually on Black faculty studies that also has very strong contact with the study of religion. And that's a book that's under contract with Johns Hopkins University Press. It's actually overdue, called Ivory Towers, if I can remember the title, Ivory Towers, Regulatory Technologies and the Reproduction of Anti-Black Violence in the Academy, Introducing Black Faculty Studies. And my co-authors are Dr. Lori Latrice Martin, who's a sociologist at LSU, and Dr. Biko Mandela Gray, who's a scholar of religion and philosopher of religion at Syracuse University. And I'm also working on another book after that on a religious figure by the name of Robert T. Brown, who was a precursor of the Harlem Renaissance, who was an occultist, who had a short life in theosophy. He was a theosophist for a little while, who was also a Pan-African nationalist who worked with Marcus Garvey in New York in the 1930s, very closely with him in the 1930s, who was one of the most important and significant figures of his time in the 1920s or 30s. And yet we've forgotten all about him. There's hardly any scholarship on Robert T. Brown, who I argue can help us think about theory of religion at the intersection of race, the occult, quantum mechanics, and other esoteric ideas that we glean from Robert T. Brown. And that book is under contract with Oxford University Press. But again, I'm behind on that one too.
Well, we won't hold you in any way against that. So good luck with all of that.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this wonderful book, and thanks for making time to talk about it.
Thank you for your time, your insightful questions, and your patience.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Stephen Finley about his wonderful new book, In and Out of This World, Material and Extraterrestrial Bodies in the Nation of Islam, published with Duke University Press in 2022. We appreciate your support on New Books in Islamic Studies.